Everyone's got those songs that make them go, "Oh man, I felt that." Songs that resonate with their own individual circumstances and bring them together with others through shared connection. But the same song is guaranteed to speak to different people in vastly different ways. So join Jordan and I, once childhood neighbors in Marathon City, Wisconsin, as we talk through the songs that have struck a chord with us. We'll discuss the similar messages that we've heard upon our listens, the lessons that we've learned through our own interpretations, and the deeper topics that we're navigating as our unique journeys continue beyond our hometown. Welcome to Marathon Mixtapes. Jordan, what song are we talking about today?
Well, Dayton, for this week, I decided to pull a song from the TikTok just because I wanted to feel young again. I didn't actually hear this.
I thought this was a TikTok song, but I'm not on that platform, but I catch things through osmosis through my wife and my younger in-laws. I'm glad I'm not completely off base here.
No, it's a song that came from TikTok, got famous from TikTok, but I don't use TikTok either. And I think I heard it from some other medium like Spotify or YouTube. But in any case, it's a fairly recent song, which is probably why it was big on TikTok for a while. But the song itself is "Numb Little Bug" by M. Behold. And I think this song really captures, I think, the younger generation's like vibe of life, of going through COVID and the lockdowns and other things like that, that really just makes you think of kind of the cruelties of the world. And it's one of the few songs I've heard in recent years that is pretty explicit with its lyrics. So in a lot of songs that, you know, evoke those deeper feelings and contemplation, I feel a lot of times the lyrics are written to be a little bit vague to allow for the listener to do their own contemplation and extrapolation to get to something that resonates with them. But "Numb Little Bug," I feel like, is more in the opposite of camp, where it just comes right out and just tells you what she's thinking or what the song lyrics are trying to convey.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm glad you're mentioning this right up front, because I won't get put the cart before the horse here, obviously, but that is something that I wondered as I listened to the song. It's like, okay, how literal are we talking here? How literal are the medications and the anxieties that she's mentioning, this character that M. Behold is embodying here in this song? So I'm totally with you here. I'm glad that you kind of went in with the same approach.
Yeah, I mean, I think M is just singing as herself in this song specifically. And it's all about, for people that haven't heard the song before, the lyrics really just come straight out and talk about her depression and anxiety and her ways to cope with that through medication, mostly medication, honestly, and other more like maladaptive strategies for coping. Like I said, it comes right out of the bat swing, or right out of the gate swinging, where like the first couple lines are, "I don't feel a single thing. Have the pills done too much?" Like, that's pretty blatant, I think, in my mind. But one of the most key lyrics, I guess, for me when I listen to the song is the first two stanzas of the chorus, because I think it does a really good depiction of what depression is like, at least in my opinion. And those lyrics being, "Do you ever get a little bit tired of life? Like, you're not really happy, but you don't want to die."
Yeah.
I think that, for me, is a big resonator, just because personally, I think that is something that I feel, or I have felt a lot of the time in my past, and is something that I think a lot of people that I know that kind of give off high functioning depressives in society also kind of give off a little bit. But again,
would you call it apathy?
It's
because that's kind of the term that came to mind with me with this song. I feel like it does a great job of capturing that feeling of not feeling really ambitious in either direction, not necessarily inherently or proactively or consciously self-destructive, but also not really pushed to improve oneself either. You're just like, you're just kind of there. There's even a lyric there where I don't have it written down offhand, but where it's like your body's in the room, but you're not really there. It's something along those lines.
Yeah. I think the line is like your body's in the room, but you're not really there. Like you have empathy inside, but you really don't care. I think it's a little bit more nuanced than apathy. I think it's apathy with extra steps or apathy with extra context. Because you could easily say like burnout too. It's not necessarily quite standard apathy. But a lot of the lyrics I get from this song is that like M is trying. I think that's the thing. It's, to me, this whole song in a nutshell is M singing about, you know, her anxiety and depression, trying to fit in, not fit in, but, you know, trying to function in society and not really being there despite the effort. And then there's lyrics about like taking antidepressants and everything. I think in the second verse, there it starts out with like the prescription's on its way with a name I can't pronounce and the dose I gotta take, boy I wish that I could count. And you can see kind of like the push to take high doses of, you know, medicine to try and feel something, right? Like you said, like your body's in the room, but you're not really there. There's like that feeling of emptiness, which I think is connected to empathy, but like a different aspect to that whole like malaise that I think people with depression kind of inhabit a lot of the time, where it's not only the fact that you feel stuck, but sometimes you feel stuck even though you have put in effort. Especially when you like kind of compare yourself with the people you see in the real world, right? But again, when you're out there and you look, see other people interacting in society, you, just like social media, you're only seeing like a facet of somebody's life. And many times you're seeing them on like the above average time, or, you know, when you're in a public space, you put on a mask to project a more content state of satisfaction than you might be feeling on average. It reminded me of a YouTube short, or it's a YouTube video, but it's like a minute long, by Jack Stauber. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He makes a lot of like weird old like crunchy animations where like it looks like it was made in like the 70s and 80s that would play like on a CRT TV. But it's
the
a
name
guy that
sounds so familiar.
Yeah, so this video that I'm thinking of is like this guy standing out in the rain, and he kind of looks at the camera and he's like, well, I don't really mind the rain, but it's just that I don't want to get wet. And then he walks under an awning, and like the animation is, looks like they're just like sliding like images over top of each other, which I think is like his aesthetic. So he goes under the awning, but it's like still raining, and the rain like is in like the foreground of the screen, and but it looks like the rain is still like falling on him. And then he the guy looks up, he's like, "What? What's going on? I did what I was supposed to do. It's not fair." And then he frowns, and then the video's done. Like, it's a very short video. But I bring that video up because I think very much, very similar to the song Numb Little Bug, there's a feeling that when you have depression or some form of like mental hang up, you end up, at least in the beginning, going through the same motions as everybody else, but then you don't necessarily end up in the same place, or at the very least, like, it doesn't fix anything, you know? Like, if some people's like, oh, I work out to stay happy, and then you're, oh, that sounds good, and then you work out, but I'm like, I'm still sad. Like,
yeah,
I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Like, why isn't it working for me? And
right.
So with Numb Little Bug, I really get that feeling of trying so hard to not be sad or not be, you know, apathetic or sad. But the chorus really puts into perspective, you know, just line after line, like, you're not really happy, but you don't want to die. Like, you're hanging by a thread, but you got to survive just because you're told to survive. Your body's in the room, but you're not really there. Like, you have empathy inside, but you don't really care. And then the last line to the chorus, like, you're fresh out of love, but it's been in the air, to me, kind of reiterates that feeling of effort that she's been, like, she tried in the past, but she got to the point where, like, she wasn't getting the results she wanted, and it's just kind of wore her down. And then mm-hmm. she's turned to, you know, these medications that hopefully will help. And throughout the song, there's a lot of lyrics that kind of talk about that too, where she talks about all her quick repairs to cope and mm-hmm. trying to stay afloat. Bit tired of sinking, there's water in my boat, so I've got these quick repairs to cope. So, like, all in all, I think, as I mentioned at the top of this episode, it's a little refreshing for me to hear a song that's so explicit with kind of the hardships of, like, depression and anxiety in a pop song, where if when you listen to the song, you have these lyrics, but it's sung to a melodic track that's pretty, like, upbeat, and honestly, like, you could dance to it.
Oh, yeah. I think that's what really struck me as I spent more and more time with this song. I wasn't familiar with it until you had showed it to me, and then I heard my wife listening to TikToks in the other room or Instagram reels, and suddenly I was like, oh, wait, that's that MB Hold song. And I think what has lingered with me is this idea that it's kind of a lampoon of some of those toxic positivity, like, inspirational anthems, like empowerment anthems. Like, there's DNA here in this song that feels a little like Pink or Sarah Bareilles. Not to discredit Sarah Bareilles, I'm not as much of a fan of Pink, so maybe I can discredit her here a little bit. But those big, like, plunky piano hits and this, like, the big chorus, it feels like it should be a song that's saying, like encouraging the listener, like, yeah, you gotta survive. But no, like, the way that the song contextualizes that phrase and the way that M delivers it, it feels like an obligation, right? And I think that's a super powerful idea to convey through the medium of, as you said, specifically pop music. I think there's a fun contrast inherently happening in this song because of how familiar it sounds at times, but how unfamiliarly bold the lyrics are and how real and grounded they feel at times in these specific details of medicating and wondering if you're really present in a moment or not. And another element that has really stuck with me, and I've been thinking about in preparation for this episode, is the question of quick repairs, I believe is the phrase that is used in the song.
Mm-hmm.
She characterizes medications that way. Now, certainly, you know, medications for mental health, certainly those work for some people and not for others. And I think here is a very specific scenario where she sees it as putting a Band-Aid over a potential larger wound, something that's bleeding out beyond the edges of a simple bandage. So I thought about that within the context of my life, too. Like, I have started to exercise more, and I've started to make these small little changes in life, but are those adding up to a big fundamental change? Or are those small little changes even in service of these big changes? Like, why am I doing them? Is the self-improvement as simple as that, or is there some other issue I'm trying to address? I think the fact that a song like this that's as bright and poppy as this one, the fact that it makes me think about those kind of things is a huge credit to it.
Yeah, yeah. And for me personally, I think I have also gone through a lot of what these lyrics are saying. I think as someone who has kind of lived through, or not even through, like lives with depression, and I've gone through these chapters of quick repairs to cope in getting prescriptions for antidepressants, and it really does remind me of like those, that time when I like started and having just like thinking, will this work, and if it does, how's it gonna work, just because like I had gotten to a point where like I needed to try and do something different. And very much like M says in the song, after the end of the chorus, there's the line like, am I past repair? And just talking about the prescriptions with the line, because I just want to see if this could make me happy. And I'd like to think that anybody who's listened to the song that has been on antidepressants probably feels very similarly, or at least like understands that, I don't know if the word is hope, but like a bit of hope, a bit of desperation of trying to fix something that is clearly wrong. And I think it's nice, at least in our current age, when mental health has been talked about more openly than say 15, 20 years ago, there's more stories of people talking about their experience with antidepressants, therapy, other forms of psychiatry to help with mental illness. And I think I also wanted to pick this song to talk about today, just to kind of further that conversation about mental health and how, not necessarily it's like an issue that has gotten worse, although you could argue with the current state of the world, maybe it's a little bit more prevalent than the past, but I think it's more of a visibility issue where, fortunately for us as a society, we're talking about this more and more kind of out in the open. And it's nice to see that we're kind of finally addressing an issue like mental health, and a little like bittersweet that, like, you know, it's still such an issue, but we could talk about this later. But I feel like it's kind of just human nature when I like think about it to the ends of like my logic of kind of where kind of depression falls in terms of a necessity or not, in terms of progressing us as a species, or using it as like a survival mechanism to not be like lazy or something like that. But I was curious about kind of like, when you were listening to this song, did you have any of these like thoughts about like the fact that we have this song that's so open about mental health troubles, compared to songs, say, like, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, it definitely feels like a difference maker. It's not that it's, this is the only song to kind of do this, but it's one of the songs that most openly bears not just the fact that the singer, the narrator, is struggling with mental health, but that the process of grappling with it is really ugly. Like, I think that's sort of the next natural step in a lot of these conversations. Like, I pretty openly talk to not necessarily strangers, but, you know, say my parents bring a friend around and they ask about what I've been up to the past couple of years, and they maybe ask about my relationship with work. Obviously, it's not going to be so direct as that, but it might come to a point where, hey, I have to talk about my anxiety. I'll pretty openly offer that I have an anxiety disorder to most people. I'm pretty comfortable talking about that. But I think what's different with this song is that it's not just like, oh, I feel this sense of malaise. It's that my fight with it is not a pleasant one, and it's not a simple one. So I think that's what sets this song apart for me. I think we've started to see, maybe over the past 10 years, songs that are very openly about mental health and, you know, the various things that people do to address it, healthy or not. But the fact that this one digs in a little bit and says, I'm trying all these things, not all of them are working, and I'm really frustrated about it, I think is special, honestly. So
yeah.
I was really impressed with this song in that way. And again, within the pop package, I think it just makes it all the more rich with meaning. And I think there's a certain kind of irony to the fact that this song took off on TikTok. You know, I think there's something to be said about a song like this being found on social media, a place where a lot of us see our mental ailments accelerated, exacerbated. I know certainly I feel that way about my anxiety. I've had to set social media timers on my phone because I find myself just doom scrolling and looking for not necessarily something to be mad about, but sort of just looking around and making sure, okay, am I all up to speed on the things I should be mad about, right? It's really challenging. So this song taking off in the way that it did, yes, ironic, but also kind of a silver lining to social media as it exists nowadays. I imagine you found this song. I don't remember if you specifically said what platform through which that you found it, or if you recall, but did you find it through social media, and did that contextualize it right out the gate for you a little bit differently than you would have if you had stumbled across it in, oh boy, listening to it in a store or something like that?
Yeah, like, oh boy, what kind of store is playing this just over the loudspeakers? I'm not quite sure, you know, where I heard it. I think I might have seen it on some short form social media platform. I can't imagine it was TikTok because I don't use TikTok. But it might have been on like an Instagram reel, or probably not even Instagram reel because I didn't really start using Instagram until recently. But it might have been a YouTube short or something. But I think it was some short form content, because I think it just starts right at the chorus where M sings, you know, you ever get a little bit tired of life, like you're not really happy but you don't want to die. And I'm like, whoa, right off the bat. I mean, yes, but I thought there'd be like a little more foreplay before we got to the heavy stuff, you know, like
we barely know each other, M, come on.
But like, I'm you know, kudos to you for just going straight to this, that we can just skip the whole small talk bit, you know, and actually like have a conversation. I also want to mention that I think you're right. Like the fact that it is a pop, more poppy song, I think helps legitimize it. Maybe not legitimize, but like make it feel more impactful or intentional. Because I'm trying to think of, you know, in the past, before, you know, 2015, 2010, there were songs like this, you know, singing about how, you know, life sucks. I feel nothing. Depression sucks. Like Linkin Park or like Limp Bizkit or like, you know, those like Evanescence. But I think,
yeah, it's kind of an emo theme, right?
Yeah. And I think the emo theme actually kind of detracts from the impact sometimes, because they go way too hard into it, where it's like, I'm so edgy. I've got all the, like the black mascara, makeup, and something, and like life sucks, and you're like, all right, you're going through a phase or something, or like, you know, it's just like, all right, try to like tone it down a bit. Where the fact that this song "Numb Little Bug" is more poppy kind of does recontextualize those feelings, and it, to me, it paints a picture of someone who is like a pop star or like a quote unquote normal person, but then like going through these things, and it's not something that you would necessarily know from just like looking at them. And I think what separates that from like the more like physically emo looking, you know, bands that sing, you know, like punk rock and like the really edgy genres, is that when you have an external appearance that like that shows off that, it feels like you're trying to get attention. Whereas when you have these lyrics that's like painted over with like the pop genre, to me, that kind of feels like someone who's trying to portray themselves as normal, but is hiding these like mental illnesses like underneath. And I think that resonates with me a little more, because, you know, as someone that has depression, I have always been well aware of it and like the effects of what it can do to those around me. And I don't want to be in the camp of just like trauma dumping on people, because that's not really something that people, or at least that's not something I feel like I want to just unload on people, right? Like, we're all together in a shared space. I don't want to be the downer. And so I try not to be that, and try to be more like a poppy, you know, pop version on the outside, even despite what's going on, you know, in the inside. So I think that's why like this genre of music with these lyrics kind of had a bigger impact on me, as opposed to some of the more like just, you know, emo to the 11 songs.
Yeah. And I think all of us, to a degree, no matter what we're grappling with, are trying to at least mask. And then on top of that, we might be trying to fake it till we make it, right? You know, I know certainly I found myself doing that with, I don't personally struggle with any diagnosed depression, but anxiety is really my demon. And sometimes I do find myself sort of feigning confidence to just get through a day, or just to reassure somebody. And sometimes that gets me through, and other times that creates that greater dissonance where I feel like this sort of split with between myself, where there is the outside Dayton that's just trying to put on these appearances and make sure everybody else isn't upset by what I'm going through, much like what you're describing with your depression. Mm-hmm. And then there's this internal self that's saying, hey, what are you doing? Like, we're struggling with being honest or being convenient to other people here. Now, of course, there's always a time and a place. As you said, trauma dumping is not necessarily something that we want to subject people to at any given moment. But songs like this help us see that sort of conflict, that balance that we're trying to strike between feeling what we gotta feel, or sometimes not feeling something and pretending to feel something, like M does in this song. Like, that does damage. And I appreciate what people do to try to get through the day, but also at the same time, I feel like so many of us are still scared to be honest. I was talking with a friend the other day, and they express similar thoughts to what you were, where they were like, oh, I don't want to trauma dump on you. It's like, no, I'm here. I'm willing to listen. Where it's almost like we still haven't found those. A lot of us haven't found safe spaces where honesty can really thrive, and where honesty can do its best work, you know? So I think the fact that this is the genre of this song conflicts, quote unquote, with the lyrics of this song so much is also one of my favorite aspects. It feels very much like I'm a big fan of horror media and even some of like the cheap schlocky kind of commercialized stuff, like the stuff that you see on YouTube, Five Nights at Freddy's, Poppy Playtime. A lot of that stuff is, yeah, it's kind of trendy. It's more for kids. I still enjoy watching it because it has that inherent dissonance to it, because it has these really cutesy kind of familiar childhood-esque characters, things and aesthetics that are calling back to a very innocent time being corrupted in a very clear way oftentimes. And I think those types of contrasts in media kind of grab you by the collar and say, hey, pay attention, we're trying to say something. I think I might be giving a little bit of credit, a little bit too much credit to some of those mascot horrors, but I think there's something to be said about playing with that contrast and using that to, at the very least, even if you don't have something to say, grabbing people's attention.
Yeah, for sure. And that reminded me, I think I was out with my family and I was like watching my nephew run around like an aquarium, just like talking to other kids randomly. And I don't know if it was my cousin who's like 15 years older than me, or like my parents or my aunt or uncle, where it's just like we were talking and I was like, yeah, I remember when I was, you know, that age at like around like 4 to 6, like I was also in the same boat and like really happy and going and trying to make friends wherever I could. And I think it might have been my mom, where she's like, man, what happened? And I was like, I don't know, man. Depression, I guess. That's what happened as I got older. And it just like took the wind out of my sails at some point. Another thing I like about this song is the kind of gentle hinting of how things like this, like anxiety and depression, it kind of eats away at you like little by little. And I think M kind of uses the metaphor of just like a boat that's just slowly taking on water. And even when you have like a sinking boat that's kind of just got small leaks that are kind of just letting in water, sometimes you don't really notice until it's too late. Or if you do notice, you do something quick, like she says, a quick repair to cope. You put like a Band-Aid on it and hopefully you call it good and then you ignore it. And then what ends up happening later is that the Band-Aid falls off, or there's just a bunch of other small leaks that pop up, and then it becomes like a death by a thousand cuts. And I think by the time a lot of people realize that they might have, you know, some form of depression, anxiety, or other like negative mental hangups, it's at a point that like, not that it's not like too late or anything, but just like when you like realize where you're at, you're like, whoa, like you don't realize how bad it's become, I think, because of the slow, gradual nature.
Yeah.
Was that like, yeah, I was going to ask, like, for your anxiety, was that something that you noticed, like when you got to a point where you realized you had, you know, these issues?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost uncanny how much it aligns with what you're describing. And if you're willing to share, I'd love to hear your experience with your depression too, and when it started sort of percolating and getting to those points where it became too much. I became aware that something was really wrong when I started having nocturnal panic attacks. So my anxiety disorder manifests primarily in these. They're not quite night terrors. I'm conscious during them. Nocturnal panic attack is the technical term. I'll usually wake up in cold sweat, hyperventilating. I always describe to people, it feels like my brain is skipping. And the image that's in my mind, I'm a pretty visual thinker. The image in my mind, it like, I literally can't, it's like being locked in a freaking like saw, to keep the horror theme going, like in a saw like mechanism and being forced and eyes peeled open, you know, Clockwork Orange style, staring at something and something's just being repeated. It doesn't even have to be menacing, but that's how my panic attacks manifest. It's often like bizarre geometric shapes just making repeated movements, or sometimes it's even like I'm recalling a clip from a video I watched earlier in the day. Again, not even necessarily horror related. They have been, but other times they've been something as innocuous as seeing like creative Lego builders test the strength of Lego pieces. That was a very distinct image I remember having in my brain during a nocturnal panic attack one time. It was just the repeated breaking and unbreaking of a Lego piece. And so I'm having all these physical reactions. My brain is stuck on a particular frame, either from my day or some other thing it's imagined. And the first time I remember distinctly having these experiences was towards the end of high school. Very fitting, since in our last episode we discussed how challenging at times the transition from high school to college was for me, a big starting over in many ways and in other ways not. And as I was preparing to make that move, I started having these panic attacks fairly regularly. And my parents, very, very supportive people when it came to my mental health at that time, and they still are, but they took me in and, you know, they checked some standard stuff, you know, making sure it wasn't some sort of kind of gland issue or something like that. And because sometimes these panic attacks can be tied to that, but I'm no medical expert, but that's certainly what I was told at the time. And eventually I was put briefly on an antidepressant to try to manage these panic attacks. I wasn't taking the antidepressant regularly. It was just sort of on an as-needed basis, but I didn't end up really using them too much. I really just focused on forging forward, and as I went into college, I didn't necessarily experience these panic attacks within the first couple years I was there, and then later as the pressures of work and completing my degree on time and making some changes to try to make sure I was pursuing what I wanted in life, until some of those things came into focus, did those panic attacks start to come back. And that was really the moment for me when I realized maybe I just deal with a low-grade anxiety all the time. And I started cognitive behavioral therapy, and I've been in it for a number of years now. And it's been a lot of slow realization that, oh, I've been anxious since day one. I've been a worked up kid since I was a worked up kid. I think a lot of people, you know, there's sort of the joke that goes around online where people say, oh, you know, oh, that kid's an old soul. That's just a polite way of saying like that a kid is creepy. I wish I remembered what people would say about me, that I was shy or a little bit bookish or a little bit skittish. I think that was really a lot of my anxiety manifesting at a very young age. I remember being very upset with myself when I would break rules or I would accidentally say something that I didn't want to, or that I regretted in some capacity. I think a lot of how I held on to those things was my anxiety presenting itself in an earlier, more innocuous form. And then the panic attacks were the real wake-up calls to be like, hey, this maybe some things aren't connected the way that you want them to be connected up there. So that's certainly how I felt about my anxiety for the past couple years. Is it does recontextualize a lot of my childhood and a lot of the ways that I behaved when I was a kid and the things that, again, I grabbed onto as a kid, and other things that I would let go and not necessarily appreciate as much as I should have. But now I'm trying to see, you know, trying to give myself some grace and see it a little bit more of a healthy way. But regardless, when your body starts to respond in an involuntary way, that's a pretty strong indicator that there might be something worse going on. Again, I'm no medical expert, and, you know, as many years as I've been in therapy now, I don't want to claim to have everything figured out, but that's certainly how I see it. Did you have those moments when you realized, oh, hey, my depression is really presenting itself, or, oh, hey, when I did this as a kid, that was maybe this, you know, and I don't mean to diminish the word depression to just sadness, but it's like, oh, that was kind of a sadness presenting itself, or a negativity presenting itself. Obviously, more depression's more complex than that, but did you have those moments of realization?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for sharing your story. I know that, like, talking about this can be hard, but I think both of us being in therapy has definitely helped us, I think, be more confident in just sharing our stories. But for me, I think there was a number of times in, you know, my life where, like, I looked back and I can realize, like, yeah, this was like a clearly like a depressive episode. And I think for me, I was always, before I sought help and sought like therapy, I would have my own quick ways to cope. And it would be more or less kind of like just running away from the problem or ignoring it. I think a lot of, or I guess a major part of the depression that I have kind of stems from a consistent like low self-esteem and not being brought up thinking of what I wanted to do. So, like, you know, from a young age, like all the way through high school, I think a lot of my actions were, you know, for other people, kind of, where, you know, my parents would tell me to do things and I would strive to do them because I wanted to, you know, to make them proud. I would, same thing with like teachers, they want me to excel, so I would do my best there so I could, you know, do it for them. And then when I got to college, that was kind of like the first step of really doing things for yourself. And as the years kind of went on, I realized more and more that I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and everything had been like, you know, for the sake of others. Like, oh, my parents are like, oh, you gotta grow up and become a doctor. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'm becoming a doctor now. And whenever I would ask myself kind of like what I wanted, I could never, like, I would always kind of draw a blank. And so to kind of avoid thinking longer on that, I would be like, well, my parents want me to be successful, so I guess I will take the steps I think will get me to that point. And then I think there were a lot of times in college where I would have kind of just big periods of sadness, to put it simply. But I think I, at that point, had gotten fairly good at like masking it, you know, or kind of ignoring it, or at least, you know, if I'm out with friends in a social group, I could at least like put it on hold and just not think about it too much, like putting on, you know, the mask, if you will. And then when I got to grad school, I think life got more stressful just because of the demands of grad school, where I was pretty much like working in a lab like 6 to 7 days a week. And some days I'd be in the lab until like midnight, and then I'd go home just to wake up at like eight, or just to wake up to get back to the lab at like, you know, 8 or 9. And so there was a lot of that. And I would always just kind of reason away that, like, you know, it'll be worth it in the end. But it definitely, at the time, like looking back on it, definitely was not super great for my mental health there. Cause I was still like pushing myself as hard as I was for the sake of other people and not necessarily for me. And by the time, and I think there were a lot of moments that it both helped and hindered, I guess, my healing. In that I remember I got really burnt out in the early years of grad school. But my lab also moved from Madison to Boston around my third year of grad school, which was kind of, which was at a point where it was pretty bad. And I think had that move not happened, I probably would have sought out help from a professional earlier. But because of the whole moving a lab, research pretty much had to stop as we packed a lab, you know, moved across states and then reset it up. And that pause actually, I guess, did help me a little bit, but it kind of just prolonged me not seeking help because I thought I was, you know, it was just like a quick break, but it didn't actually like address anything. And then grad school continued. And I think around my fifth year, I remember another kind of like depressive episode where I was just kind of laying in bed. And I remember, I don't remember when this happened, but I do remember this moment succinctly where it was like a random weekend, middle of the day. I was at home and I was just laying on my bed, staring at the ceiling. And I just like started crying and then was like thinking, can I just be happy? But like not also not knowing what that meant. I was just kind of like grasping at like the ether for what I thought was happiness, but didn't know how to contextualize or like what that happiness would have been. I was just kind of like asking like to the random void. And then I think that was the kind of wake up moment for me to like seek out help. And I remember talking to therapists. We can get to this a little bit later because it's a little unrelated, but I've had like five different therapists in 5 years for different reasons. But every time you get a new one, you have to fill out this like checklist or like little survey questionnaire for anxiety and depression. And there's always one that question or statement that's like how close you are to like physically like harming yourself. Because obviously some people with like severe depression, you know, that's a really valid risk that could happen, you know. And I remember talking, every time I got a new therapist, I remember talking about that. And it might have been a reason why I didn't seek out help sooner. But I think whenever I was in one of those depressive episodes, I would never get to a point where I would actively seek to harm myself. But I definitely got to points where I just became so apathetic that I would have been fine just laying there and laying wherever I was indefinitely and like decaying. And I think that's why like this song, Numb Little Bug, kind of stuck with me, because that line of being tired of life, not really happy, but you don't want to die, it was such like a specific feeling and picture that instantly see like myself in that picture, a form of how my like depression had manifested itself. I remember also going to, not necessarily like signing up for a therapist, but I remember in grad school, there were like office hours that MIT Medical had like once a week or something, where you could just drop in with a licensed therapist that was employed by MIT Medical to just like talk. So it was kind of like office hours for like, you know, mental health. And I remember just, you know what, finally taking the time out of my schedule to just go and just talk to somebody. And I remember describing how like this whole life I've been building this mask that I wore around others because it was what I thought I needed to be. And then it wasn't until like I think the way I put it was the mask that I had began cracking to such an extent that I couldn't repair it fast enough. And I was worried that I would just like have a complete mental breakdown. And so, you know, that helped me seek out help. And honestly, when I think about it, it's fortunate that I would think I was able to realize this, because I know a lot of stories of people with, you know, anxiety and depression that may not have the wherewithal to notice that like point of no return and end up kind of suffering a complete mental breakdown, which is really unfortunate. All that to be said, there was a time where I think the periods of depression got frequent enough that I started to notice them. I think, you know, looking back, it had always been there, but I think when I was younger, they were small leaks, and it wasn't until I got older where those small leaks kind of either got bigger or more of them kind of started popping up that I kind of took a step back, look at my life, and realize like, oh, this boat is definitely sinking and I don't have enough hands to like plug up all the holes. And again, I think I'm fortunate enough to be in that I was in a position where I could recognize that and then actually go seek a registered professional. And I've been in some form of that, like therapy, I think like cognitive behavioral therapy, or like talk therapy for I think like 5 years now. But in the past, I've also like met with psychiatrists. I've had antidepressants as well. Honestly though, like in my experience, I think the antidepressants were only useful as like a kickstart to get like my life back in some semblance of order. I like to tell people that like I was on such a high dose of a specific antidepressant, like the psychiatrist that I was meeting kept slowly upping the dose, I think to the point where like I was taking like the maximum dose of Wellbutrin, and it started to affect my memory. But it affected my memory in a good way. I will say, when I was taking those antidepressants, I think they did help me get to a point of neutrality that I could kind of take action to get to do more to better my mental health. And once I got to that point of neutrality, like I started exercising more, which definitely helped. But to go back to like the memory issues with antidepressants, you know, you have a schedule. And I remember my doctor saying like, oh, if you forget to take it on a specific day, because I was only, you know, you take one a day. If you forget, don't try to like back adjust or take it retroactively. Kind of count that day as a loss and just keep going normally. The antidepressants were messing with my memory enough that I kept forgetting whether or not I had actually taken one. And then because of that, I slowly weaned myself off of the antidepressant and didn't see like a huge backslide back into depression, because I think at that point I had gotten into a more like regular exercise routine. And I think like the exercise actually also did help me out a little bit. And I was seeing, you know, at that time I was still consistently talking to a therapist, which I found very useful, not just for like feedback from a licensed therapist, but also like just having a space to vocalize kind of issues that I feel like I've encountered or things that I kind of looking back on my life as a child and teenager, like realizing things in the moment. I think just having a space to say that out loud has helped me significantly as well. It's also nice that to know that like I can do it in a space with somebody else and it's like their job to listen, right? Like before I said, I don't want to just like trauma dump on my friends, because I just don't want to do that to them with like when they didn't ask for it. But at least, you know, when you go see a doctor for mental health, like, you know, that's kind of the expectation. You know, you're there to like talk about your troubles and whether how you feel about them and what you could do to address it, you know, moving forward.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that, man. I know it's not easy, especially as you were describing some of those times when you would kind of just lay and be content with, the word you used was decaying. And yeah, that's it's heartbreaking to hear that you felt that way. And, you know, I think it goes without saying, but, you know, goodness knows that, you know, we always, I as your friend, always want you to make sure that as you're able to take care of yourself and always lean on and be in your other friends to help take care of yourself when you need that extra hand too. So again, hopefully that goes without saying, but sometimes the vocalized reminders are always helpful too. But as you were describing that scenario, it brought me back to the title of this song too, which I think is a very, very gutsy one. Numb little bug. It's a really kind of an innocuous line as part of the lyrics, but I think there's a lot of meaning in it. And the fact that this, you know, the song very easily could have been called Tired of Life or something like that, and maybe been a little bit more approachable or a little bit less ambiguous, I guess. But the fact that it's zeroed in on this line, I found very powerful, because it introduced this extra layer of M thinking about insignificance, maybe. There's a lot of meaning packed behind somebody thinking of themselves as an insect, right? And as you were talking about those moments of really strong, not just emotional, but like physical apathy too, I think, you know, a beetle flipped over on its back is it's hard not to picture sometimes. So it the title of the song really struck me in that way, thinking about how when we're struggling with extreme depression or intense anxiety, how a lot of it, and you said it yourself, goes back to a low self-esteem too, just a low thought of yourself where it's like, I'm not doing enough, I'm not doing the right things. I feel like I'm doing the right things, but they're not working in the way I was told that they were going to work. A lot of that does make us feel less than fully formed, less than human sometimes. So I really appreciate M putting, I don't know if it was her decision, but it certainly seems like it was, to put that theme, that idea, that extra layer on blast by making the title Numb Little Bug, because when you're struggling with the weight of those extreme mental health issues, you do feel reduced kind of to a bundle of nerves, just like an exoskeleton just filled with all of these ideas and things that just keep fueling you in ways that you don't feel like you're in control of. It's like you have all the worst instincts bundled up into a little creature. And I know when I battle my anxiety, that's exactly what it feels like. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the title being what it is and not taking an easier route out in terms of making this song, you know, putting a label on this song, so to speak.
Yeah. I think you did a good job with like the little bug, because I think with these like mental health issues, it can really make you feel really small and insignificant. The numb though, I actually also really like, but I think that's more of an association of numb with the prescription medicines. Because I don't know what you remember when you were, you know, on your antidepressants, but like for me and what I've heard from other people that take antidepressants, they don't really make you happy. They just make you feel nothing. So like if you think of your emotional state, you know, on a graph, you have your ups and you have your downs, and depression, you know, obviously has your emotional state, you know, very low for more time than you'd like. And then when you take like an antidepressant, at least the ones I've taken, it didn't really like make me happy, but it did make me less sad. But it made me less sad in a very like apathetic way. Like it really just cut off the highs and the lows, which is, I think, something that unless you've taken an antidepressant, you don't realize that like it kind of just steers your emotional state towards like a very gray neutral. And so I remember when I was on or like early on taking antidepressants, at first I was a little excited because like the moments of intense sadness were kind of going away or less frequent. But then I start to notice that the things that would usually make me happy in like a short time span, like the like fleeting ephemeral happiness, those also kind of got wiped out by the antidepressants. And so it just kind of made everything gray. And honestly, like there were times when it felt very numb because there was no variance in like my emotional range at certain points of my like time with antidepressants. And something that I am glad that I was able to kind of just naturally come off of antidepressants, which is honestly something that, you know, not everybody is fortunate enough to do, is that it's gotten me a better appreciation of those like higher highs, even though sometimes like they come with the lows. But like having one, like having both is I think still better than having neither, because just, man, being in that like just numb state really just, it really feels like you're kind of on autopilot. And honestly, like M talks about it in the song too, when, you know, you feel like you have empathy, but it, you really don't care. And like all these emotions feel like they've run out. They were there before, presumably, you know, before you started taking antidepressants to treat depression or anxiety, you had like more moments of happiness and positive emotions. But I think, yeah, something that people that aren't experienced, I guess, with like taking medication for mental health issues don't realize sometimes, that when you, these medicines aren't very, you know, precise in what they kind of erase. And along with like the sadness and the negative emotions, they tend to also erase some of the positive emotions that you're trying to get to, which is honestly why I think they're a good first step, depending on, you know, your specific situation. But from what I've found, you know, like having that as a start to get to a state of neutrality, and then having someone to talk to, like a licensed professional about these things in talk therapy, in cognitive behavioral therapy, I think that helps in a different way that I think is also as important in the long run. And so I kind of want to ask, like, you know, we've talked to each other before about how, you know, we have a therapist that we see now. How did you get started seeing a therapist?
Oh, I'm glad you asked this, because it's, I am always willing to share my process with people. I have had a number of friends approach me and ask how I got started. And I've had to search for therapists now twice in my life. And you learn a lot real fast, you know, but after I was leaving a job where the work environment was really toxic, and I didn't have a plan. I was just like, all I know is I need to get out. And I had put in a very generous, like 2 months until I was going to leave. And then I started seeing a therapist, and I began by, at the time I was still on my parents' insurance, I went through my father's insurance's employee assistance program. That is a great place to start, I think, because it takes away some of the sort of logistical worries of finding a therapist, right? You know, you at least get a handful of free, quote-unquote, sessions. You know, you're paying it through your insurance, but they're ready for you at basically any given time. And you know you can kind of find somebody who, if needed, they'll be on your insurance, and you don't have to worry about aligning some of those pieces as much. Beyond that, that was the route I initially took. I worked with my father's insurance, found out which therapists near me were available. Obviously, they can get much more specific from there. You know, some people are more confident with men, women, different gender expressions, or with people who have very specific experiences with not just blanket anxiety or blanket depression necessarily, but the therapists I've sought out have explicitly been those who are dealing with like workplace anxieties or employment issues. Thankfully, I've never had any issues being employed, but I've had issues with being employed. Like, if that makes any sense. But I sought out specifically therapists who had focused on that, who had experience with occupations and the anxieties that come with being a worker in 2025 America, you know. And so that was really the route I took the second time I sought out a therapist. I focused on finding a therapist who could really speak to the issues that I knew were triggers to me. I know the word triggers gets thrown around a lot, but I feel like it's a really accurate term because sometimes it doesn't feel like a big workup to an anxiety attack, or it doesn't feel like a big workup to a depressive episode. Sometimes it just feels like, ooh, something puts you down that track. So I continued.
If I could just interrupt.
Yeah.
That just reminded me. Yeah, I think what you said, like, trigger is definitely something that I think when you have an anxiety attack or a depressive attack, it really does feel like there was something that just kind of went, clicked something in your head from like 0 to 100. It just reminded me there was one time, and I've like told this story to like other family members as like an example, but I remember when I was in grad school and I was living in Boston, I was at an Asian grocery store and everything was fine. You know, I was going, checking in to see if they had like this milk tea that I was looking for in like little bags, you know, normal grocery store outing. And I was just perusing the aisles, and then like maybe like 5-10 feet away, there was this like young couple that just started arguing with each other in Cantonese. And it was a pretty like decent, like a heated argument. But I remember for some reason, like I just overheard bits of it. And then it just like reminded me in an instant of as a kid being in the middle of like fights between my parents when they fought and yelled at each other. You know, it was in Cantonese, and it was like a very much like, oh, I'm just at one moment, I'm just looking at the store aisles, just looking for a specific thing. And the next thing I know, I'm like, I have to get out of here. Like, I just have to.
Yeah.
I remember just like, thankfully, I don't think I had, like, I didn't have like a basket full of items. But if I did, I would have totally just dropped it on the floor and just like sped walked out of the building. I think I was holding on to something, and I just like put it on the shelf in front of me and then just kind of like booked it out of there. When you said like, I think triggers, you know, that is a word that is said a lot nowadays, but I think, you know, for valid reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're struggling with a feelings of anxiety or feelings of depression, or you know that something's just off kilter and you don't know exactly what it is, honestly, looking at those triggers is a great place to start. That's been my experience, because oftentimes starting with those core themes of your life can kind of help you unpack that. And there are specialists out there who have talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of people before you who have struggled with similar things in those realms. So they have a lot of, they've heard it before, as they say. You know, it should never feel embarrassed in therapy to share the things that upset you or put you in some kind of mood. And the right professional will help you really identify what is at the center there and help you unpack those things. So when I saw a therapist the second time, again, I looked for a therapist who was focused on addressing issues related to employment, related to having a job and performing at work to a certain level. And I also sought a therapist. While I am not personally part of the LGBTQ community, I wanted a therapist who was sensitive to those social issues, because some of the ways that my faith life has changed and my personal beliefs have changed, I've become much more socially liberal, and I wanted to make sure that my therapist could be on the side that I thought was right. That sounds really like kind of making your own echo chamber, but it's also about creating a safe space for yourself, right? Where you can talk freely about, like, this is what I believe, and you won't be judged. Mm-hmm. So I, again, I'm not part of that community, but I consider myself an ally, even though I might not always show it or vocalize it in the way that I ought to. And I wanted to make sure that my therapist was sensitive to that social issue and a lot of different social issues that stem from that. And you can, you'd be amazed at who you can find out there that can really speak to your life circumstances. It takes a lot of like work. It does. It's never fun just Googling around looking for effectively keywords associated with people's resumes for something, and reducing what you're feeling down to some of those key points at times can feel a little bit disheartening. But when you find somebody and you start having conversations with them, I feel like you find out, and I'd be curious to see what your experience has been. I feel like you find out pretty quickly about how they're listening to you and what they can really contribute to your story is being told, you know. And it doesn't always work out. That's another thing I always tell people. It's you're going to be discouraged as part of this process. You might have a few sessions with somebody and be like, nope, this isn't it. And that's not a failure on anybody's part. Like, finding a therapist and finding somebody who can speak to your specific life circumstances and the things that you're feeling, not everybody's going to be able to do that, even professionals. So it's, you can find somebody, you will find somebody, but you have to give yourself the lenience, the freedom, the sort of the patience with yourself. You have to give yourself that patience to say it might not happen right away, you know? Yeah. And I know that's something that you struggled with a little bit more than I have. So I'd be curious if you have anything further to add to that, speaking from your experience, if you're willing to share.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, briefly mentioned before, like, I had 5 therapists in 5 years. Well, actually, 5 therapists and a psychiatrist in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that was not necessarily... Well, there was some that I think might not have been a great match, but I kind of just tried to stick it out because of how frequent I kept switching therapists. And every time was not like on me, like wanting a different therapist. So I remember the first time I found a therapist, it, you know, it was fine. I was trying to start the process of kind of analyzing, you know, these feelings and looking to, you know, where they may have come from in the past. And then after about a year, I think that therapist was like, something about the insurance network changed and my insurance wasn't going to cover that. Cover the sessions anymore, and so I'd have to pay like full price out of pocket. And as a starving grad student, I did not have the money to pay for like $300 to $400 a week. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, I guess I gotta find a different one. And then I found a second therapist through MIT Medical, so it was like through the school that, you know, covered grad students. And so I got to be with this therapist for about a year again. And I think he's been one of the best ones I had out of the 5-ish.
Oh, nice.
But but then I defended and I got my PhD. And because I was no longer a grad student, for some reason, MIT Medical wouldn't cover further therapy sessions with this guy.
Mm.
And so I'm like, oh, great. And I was like, now I gotta find another one. And then I found another one through a different, you know, company that did take the insurance. That one, I think it was the worst. Not to say anything about the therapist. He was a cool guy. But I think the way it worked out, he was only available like over the phone. So up until then, I had been doing in-person sessions with the occasional like online session with like my psychiatrist if schedules didn't like work out. Because I know sometimes therapists, they work from home some days and they only do like, you know, online virtual visits. And so I had a little bit of that, but mostly they were in person. But then this third one was like always like on the phone. It was also 2021 at this point. No, 2020.
Yeah. So a highly virtual time.
I think. So. Yeah. It was basically it was COVID lockdown. Yeah. It was like COVID lockdown. So they weren't doing in-person sessions. And so it was all over the phone. And I remember like at the end of that, like looking back, being on the phone was something that I didn't want to do moving forward just because for me it was just so easy to check out and not like
sure
deal with my issues because I like it just being on the phone you can easily just like
yeah
you lose your attention and like do something else but if you're in like a you know if you're in a room like for an hour like you can't do anything else and you gotta you know talk to the therapist and actually like deal with your things. But then after a year of with this third therapist was when I moved back to Madison from Boston. And so I had to find a new therapist because of that, because I like moved locations. And again, I knew that I wanted at that point to do in-person sessions because it just felt like they were more productive than virtual and phone sessions. And then so I found a new therapist that was covered by my work insurance. But then again, after a year, I think it's just because of how the medical system in the US right now is just so overworked and there's not enough like licensed professionals, both in the mental health space and like the physical health space. It got to a point where like with my fourth therapist, his schedule was so booked up that I was only really able to meet with him like once every 6-ish weeks on average.
Mm.
And if for some reason, you know, I had to miss a session because of work or something coming up, like there weren't any spaces that I could like reschedule to around that time. And it would just be like, oh, I have to wait until the next session. So that would be like 12 weeks, you know, from the previous one. And then so he had a conversation with me saying like, oh, we have a new therapist that we think, you know, might be a good fit. And he'll be, you know, a lot less busy than I am. And, you know, we'll have the time to spend with you. And then so I moved on to my fifth therapist who I'm with now. And he's a really cool dude. And where I'm able to like talk to him, like on average, you know, once a month, which, you know, I think back when I started therapy, it was like once a week, and now it's just once a month, which to me, you know, it'd be cool if I could do it a little bit more frequently, but I understand like these things sometimes are out of like your control and I kind of like the space as is and I can kind of deal with it at the moment. You know, like I think I'm at a point after going through all these therapists and this many years in therapy that I've developed practices of mindfulness, kind of like outside of therapies to like kind of make up for the lower frequency of going to see, you know, an actual person in an actual designated space for therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to a couple of the therapists where it's just like, man, having to find five therapists in 5 years and they're always not because of me, they're because of some other, you know, thing that the universe decides to throw my way. I always kind of like half joke that like, man, is it because of me? Does the therapist not like me? And I know like that's not the case, right? Like it's just like logistics. getting in the way. But
right,
every year when the therapist is like, oh, I can't see you anymore, it does kind of suck. Because it just feels like, oh, the therapist doesn't want me anymore.
Yeah.
But you said you had two therapists. Like, how long did you see each one?
So the first one I saw only for a couple months to really ease that transition out of that toxic work environment and into a new job that I found, like, literally while I was in sessions. There were sessions where I had no job lined up, and then just a couple weeks later, I was in there with opportunities, contract signed kind of thing. So once I was in that new job, I decided to ease out on sessions and basically only visit on an as needed basis. And at that time, I determined I didn't need it. So I went into the new job, and my career really did take a more positive direction from there. And so that was only a matter of a couple months. And then my current therapist I've been with since the beginning of 2023, I believe. No, 2022, beginning of 2022. And he has just been a lifesaver, just a real reliable presence. And some of the, you had mentioned mindfulness, some of the things that he's really taught me, among them, I think what really stuck out to me and what has helped me a lot, not just as a person, but in my marriage too, is just like being willing to rely on people, like not having to shoulder the weight by yourself, you know, being able to, when you're willing to share your emotions with people, whether it is a therapist or a loved one, they more often than not, they're willing to help you carry it. And I had sort of developed this kind of toxic independence where I'm like, no, I need to figure shit out so then I can be the person I need to be for these people. And I've slowly, and due to my own sort of stubbornness, it's taken me a while. I've slowly realized that there's a lot of people who are willing to tolerate my idiosyncrasies and are willing to help me work on them. And it's like what you mentioned earlier, where the ability, the fortunateness to have that certain amount of self-awareness has it feels like a curse sometimes, but it's also really, really helpful to say like, hey, I've got this thing I'm kind of dealing with, and the right people in your life, they will often answer, yeah, that's okay, I've noticed that, or I've seen it in this ways, or even if, you know, sometimes they'll be like, yeah, that's kind of hurt me in the past, but I'm willing to help you. I think that's one of the most important things that my therapist has taught me, is just to allow myself to have those conversations. They can be upsetting sometimes because you do find out that you've hurt people or let somebody down, you know, but ultimately you walk away knowing that you've got another person to count on, right? So just really putting into concrete structures your support system, I think was one of the most important things that I walked away with, or I continue to walk away with at each session. You know, I've got another one next week, and goodness knows that I'll probably need that reminder. And I think that's something too I'd really like to emphasize here, is that for me, therapy is like maintenance. It's a constant sort of check-in. I have to fight myself once in a while when I have a session coming up and I'm like, I'm doing pretty good, I probably don't need it. But suddenly I go into that session that week having a ton to talk about that I didn't realize was kind of at the periphery bothering me, you know. It's about catching yourself before those huge wake-up calls need to happen. Excuse me, I just burped. Hilarious. Great timing, Dayton. But it's about those regular tune-ups. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily about addressing those big breakdowns, those big blow-ups that you might have with people that you're butting heads with. It's about checking in and seeing how those week-to-weeks, those day-to-days, sometimes those hour-to-hours are going, and where you might catch yourself slipping whether you want to talk about it or not, noticing those moments and bringing them up and unpacking them with somebody, I think makes a huge difference.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So we've been going on for a while, so I think we should probably wrap this episode up. So I wanted to ask you, as kind of a way to close, for anybody out there that thinks that they might be dealing with anxiety, depression, or other mental hang-ups and stresses, do you have anything to offer in terms of like advice to kind of take that first step of looking for help?
Oh gosh, yeah, it can be as simple as a Google. Like really, it's just type something into the search bar, whether it's one of those triggers that you know that you have, or one of those keywords that you know, like, yeah, I know there's therapists that deal with religious trauma or familial conflict. Just start there. Like you don't have to make any decisions. You don't even have to make any phone calls. I know our generation is very averse to picking up the phone and dialing, I know I am, but just seeing who's out there who could maybe not just sympathize with you, but help give you practical tools to get through it all, I think is reassuring in and of itself, just to see there are professionals who are prepared to deal with what you feel is you, but really is it's the extra stuff that's getting in the way of you. So I always want to try to make that step as simple as possible when I talk to people about looking for a therapist. And I would argue it doesn't get too much simpler than just typing something in and seeing what's out there. And even in I'm in a little more of a rural community now, not quite as big as Milwaukee where I once was. But I even know around here, my therapist is still out of Milwaukee. I meet with him virtually, and I even know around here that there are people, if I need to see somebody physically in the same space again and discuss these kind of issues, I know there are people I could count on. So just having that awareness is a great first step. And it'll reassure you that you're not looking for something impossible. And even if you don't quite even find that Google search, that if it doesn't return the exact results, the fact that there are people out there might be something close, there might be something adjacent, there might be, just start with some commonality, and goodness knows where it might lead you. So that's my advice. Make the process as contained, as simple as possible, and you'd be surprised at what kind of results that you can find. The goal doesn't need to be find a therapist by 12 p.m., 12 a.m. tonight. It could be mark down the number of therapists in the area, just to see, hey, there is help. So, how about you? Have you ever had anybody ask you about this process and help them take that first step? And even if not, what would your suggestion be to them?
Yeah, I guess me personally, I haven't had a lot of people offer personal like advice, but I think in the time that we're living in, there are a lot more people kind of stepping forward and kind of openly talking about their, issues and kind of how to get through it. And, I've seen a lot of actors and celebrities, comedians that I kind of would say like kind of look up to. And especially more so now when I've like learned about their personal stories about anxiety, depression, ADHD, those kinds of things. The advice that I would say would probably be something similar to what I've heard Jim Carrey talk about, is kind of just like if you find yourself in that kind of low place, it's valid to have those emotions, but I think if you can recognize that, to just do anything, and like you were saying, you don't need to find a therapist by 12 a.m. tonight. But just, you know, anything that you can think of, however small, does actually go a long way. And I guess I'll end it here with a quote from Jim Carrey talking about depression that I just remember him talking about, and I quick Googled it, where Jim Carrey said, "I believe depression is legitimate, but I also believe that if you don't exercise, eat nutritious food, get enough sleep, consume positive material, most importantly, surround yourself with support, then you aren't giving yourself a fighting chance." And I think that has helped me seek help. I think asking for help was definitely a big hang up for me as well, being kind of molded into as independent of a person as I could be. Even the smallest thing of asking for help has enormous dividends. And there are people out there that are willing to lend a hand. They just don't know it yet, but if you ask them, they would, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have people in their lives that they might not know, but would drop, you know, everything to go and help them however they can. So that's kind of what I would say to anybody like in a questionable position thinking about what to do next.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. For me, it always goes back to that support system. And I know not everyone is fortunate to have good friends or solid family structure, but there are these systems out there that are willing to step up for you. And it, as tough as it can be, taking that first step unlocks that whole world. And as you just said, that realization that there are people who are willing to help, and taking control and asking for that help, those are two things right there that can, even if temporarily, lift your spirits and put you on the right track.
So I think we'll end.
Well, one of these.
Oh, go for it. Sorry.
I was just going to say, one of these episodes we'll talk about something cheery. Good Lord.
For sure, sure. But yeah, with that, like, if you stuck around to the end, just I want to say, you know, thank you very much for listening. This episode, especially.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, if you're looking for help, you know, it's all right to ask. And honestly, you know, as always, at the end of every episode, I like to throw a shout out to our email. If you want to drop us a message at all, we have an email you can send to at marathonmixtapespodcast@gmail.com. You can always drop a line, a comment, anything, a story if you'd like to share. Anything else you want to add, Dayton, before we close it out?
No, I would just also like to reiterate that thanks for sticking with us through any episode, but this episode especially. I know it's got some. We talked about some tough things, but some important things to discuss, especially among friends. So, thanks for listening. I really appreciate it, and I know Jordan does too. So, we're excited to hear from y'all and keep these kinds of stories and these kinds of conversations going.
See you in the next one, then.
Sounds good, Jordan. You take care, brother.
You too.